This is Dr. Leslie Allen in his teaching on the book of Ezekiel. This is session number 11, God's Sword Against Sinful Jerusalem and Judah, Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 45 through chapter 23, verse 49.
Last time we were looking at Ezekiel chapter 20 up to verse 44, and then we stopped. A new section begins in 45, and I would venture to say that our chapter division in our English Bibles doesn't help us very well. There's good reason for it to start verse 21 at our present verse 1 in our English versions, because all of verse 21 is a group of messages that have a key word in them, sword, 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 all the way through chapter 21. And so that must be the reason why it was decided in the English Bible tradition that we should start there at the beginning of the chapter. But if you look at the Hebrew Bible, you see there's a different tradition, and that starts what we call 20:45 is actually 21 and verse 1 in the Hebrew Bible. And I would want to argue that that is right. But you might look through that last section in chapter 20 in our English text and say, well, I can't see the sword there. And that is very true. But in point of fact, I shall argue that really the new theme over against a new keyword, a new theme is starting in 20:45. It does make better sense. Yes, we do have a collection of messages that begin with our 21:1, and we get this sword repetition all the way through as a keyword. And yes, that keyword doesn't occur. But if we look closely, as we're going to, at that first section in our chapter 21, 1 to 7, we shall see that it is closely based on the section, the message, that begins in 20:45 to 49. And in fact, it's a deliberate reinterpretation in different terms of what was said in 45 through 49. And so let's see if that's so as we go through. But these do seem to be a pair of messages, 20:45 to 49, and then 21, 1 to 7. Overall, we are going to be moving from 20:45 to 23:49. And there is a sequence here. There's a logical sequence in these chapters, because we move from the sword, which stands for God's punishment using the Babylonians as his agents. And then in chapter 22, we go on to start explaining the reason why this punishment should happen. And in 22, we have an explanation of the sinfulness of Jerusalem that merits such punishment. When we come to chapter 23, once again, there's an explanation of the people's sinfulness, but it's the sinfulness of Judah that deserves this punishment. And so punishment, and then the reason why in the case of Jerusalem, and the reason why in the case of Judah. And so this is a good collection here with its logical sequencing. The first message, verses 45 to 49, uses a metaphor, the metaphor of a forest fire. And any of us who live in California, we would be all too aware of such a metaphor in terms of reality. Who's the arsonist? That's always the question that arises in California. Did somebody set this fire? Did somebody not put out a fire after camping in a certain place? Who's the arsonist? Well, here, the arsonist is going to be God himself. He's going to set this forest fire. And then where is the fire going to occur? Well, it depends what version you read, because in verse 46 in the New RSV, it says the Negev, the forest land in the Negev, which is the region to the very, very south of Judah. It says in 47, the forest of the Negev. Now, in point of fact, if you look at the NIV, we find a different translation, which is very valid. It says the southland, a less specific word, a more generic word, the forest land in the southland, the forest of the southland. And then we can see, what we should see, that this is a reference to Judah. It's generally a reference to Judah in this first message. When we come to the reinterpretation, as we shall see it to be, there's going to be mention of the of Jerusalem and the sanctuaries and the land of Israel, and that the land of Israel seems in this case to refer to Judah. And Ezekiel is told, verse 46, set your face toward the south. And we've met this before, that as Ezekiel was prophesying, he was to stare fixedly in the direction of the addressee or addressees. And here, of course, it's a rhetorical addressee, Judah, but he's to face away fixedly as to direction that Judah was, far away from Babylonian exile. The forest fire is going to be terribly severe. It's going to devour every green tree and every dry tree. The blazing flame shall not be quenched, and all faces from south to north shall be scorched by it. There'll be such heat from this fire. And so this is a very frightening message, burning up all the trees and even scorching the faces of everybody in the vicinity. Well, that's the message that he's told to give. Ezekiel doesn't want to give it. And he says they're not going to like this message. They're going to find this too metaphorical and too allegorical. And they say, come on, Ezekiel, speak a bit more plainly. So can I put it over in a different way, please? And that's the significance of verse 49. Ah, Lord God. That's his protest. We don't often find Ezekiel interfering, but now and then he does. He interrupts, and he's got a viewpoint of his own. So it's very striking when that happens in the book of Ezekiel. It's all the way through in the book of Jeremiah, but seldom here. I said, ah, Lord God, they're saying of me, is he not a maker of allegories? And he's afraid that this vivid imaginative metaphor won't be understood and won't be liked, won't be appreciated. And he pleads for a message that will unpack its meaning a bit more easily. Okay, says God, we'll revamp the message. And instead of the forest fire, we'll use another metaphor, but one that's easily recognizable. We'll speak of the sword. The sword. And that will obviously refer to military attack, and we're really speaking in terms of the reality of the of a military attack. And so this is the new version. We've got the old version, the end of 20, and we've got the new version, the first message in 21. And so that was the good reason why the Hebrew Bible put the break after 2044 and started the new chapter. So there's a logic in the English chapter division, but I think a better logic in the Hebrew chapter division. And so this next message in 1 through 7, it goes through it again. It's got the same meaning, but there's this new word, which is going to be a key word all the way through the messages of 21. And it's using this military language as a translation of that fire imagery used before. And we have mentioned the land of Israel, as I said, which here stands for Judah, presumably. And it mentions the capital, Jerusalem, in verse 2 of chapter 21. But now God is a swordsman, not an arsonist, he's a swordsman. And he's wielding his sword everywhere in Judah and killing everyone, just as the fire had destroyed all the trees. And there's a totality in the slaughter. And that comes out very vividly at the end of verse 3. I'm coming against you and will draw my sword out of its sheath and will cut off from you both righteous and wicked. It's going to be so total that not only the bad guys, but the good guys are going to be destroyed. And then we prick up our ears and say, oh, we've been reading earlier chapters of the book of Ezekiel, and it said that some are going to be spared. And we had that in chapter 9, and we had that in chapter 14. And now you're saying it's going to be everybody. So earlier messages had mentioned the survival of some, and so we have to say that here the totality is a rhetorical enhancement or embellishment to drive home the overwhelming nature of God's intervention against the homeland in fact, 587, because that is what is in mind ultimately. It would be a second intervention. The Babylonians had invaded in 597, but this would be so much more destructive and disastrous than 597, much more devastating. And so we bring in this notion of totality, but we're not meant to take it absolutely seriously, though it has a rhetorical point. At the end of this message, in verses 6 and 7, Ezekiel is told to engage in a symbolic action of sorts. He's to engage in loud mourning cries. I remember once that in my voluntary work as a chaplain, in fact, I was in hospital as a patient at the time, and over the corridor there was an African-American who was dying, and he did die, and his daughter came to see him for the last time in his dead state, and she started wailing, and the nurse ushered her out, but everybody in the ward was awake by then in the middle of the night. And the Israelite tradition of mourning was very vocal, and it's this vocal aspect that is pointed to here. Verse 6, moan with breaking heart and bitter grief before their eyes. Oh! And when they say to you, why do you moan? You shall say, because of the news that is come, every heart will melt and all hands will be feeble. Every spirit will faint and all knees will turn to water. See, it comes and will be fulfilled, says the Lord God. And so there's this backing up of the straightforward words with this symbolic action of mourning. And he's to say, when he's asked what he's doing, this is the proper reaction to this bad news of the message. He's doing what they all need to be doing. And this point that's made, when the news actually is a reality, every heart will melt, all hands will be feeble. And this corresponds in the former message to all the faces from south to north being scorched by the fire. So there's going to be this, and this, of course, is the reaction of the exiles of 597 to this news, when the news comes of 587. So that's the first sword message, which is a revamping of the forest fire message. But then we come to the second message, which is also a sword message, in 5 to 17. There's a grouping together in terms of these key words in this chapter. And here, the sword is represented as having an independent life of its own. It's carefully sharpened and polished by unseen hands so as to be the most efficient weapon it can be against its enemies. Verse 9, a sword is sharpened. It's also polished. It's sharpened for slaughter, honed to flash like lightning. And there it is, this wonderful, super-efficient sword. But the question comes, who is it going to be used against? Who are going to be the sword's enemies? And at this point, in verse 12, cry and wail, O mortal. He's to engage in that symbolic action of mourning, for it is against my people. It is against all Israel's princes. They're thrown to the sword together with my people. And there we are. Those are to be the enemies. It's to be against Judah. And also he's to strike his thigh at the end of verse 12. Again, this demonstration, this physical demonstration of his grief. Striking of the thigh is a cultural gesture of grief. And why? Because of the shocking truth that the sword's enemies are none other than God's own people and their government officials, as we saw in verse 12, the princes of Israel. And then we're moving on in this this message in verse 14. Strike hand to hand. There's to be this hand clap, and here obviously it's an expression of grief in the context. And but here, no, I don't think it is an expression of grief. It is elsewhere. Here it's the signal for the sword to start working. And then, after that hand clap, let the sword fall twice, thrice. It is a sword for killing, a sword for great slaughter. And we're going to be told, God speaks in verse 17 at the end, I too will strike hand to hand. I will satisfy my fury. I, the Lord, have spoken. Ezekiel's clapping of his hand. Well, God's going to give his own signal when the time comes. And of course, it's referring to the Babylonian invasion of Judah and starting the siege of Jerusalem. And this is going to begin actually in 588 and then end tragically in 587. But in between, we have this work of the sword in 16. Attack to the right, engage to the left, wherever your edge is directed. This is the call to the sword. Do your grisly work. So it's all very frightening. Actually, 8 to 17 is in poetry, as the layout of your English Bible may suggest, but Ezekiel usually works in prose, and we're going to go back to prose again in 18 through 27, except that 25 to 27 is to be poetry once more. And the next sword message covers 18 to 27, and it begins with God ordering Ezekiel to carry out a symbolic action. And the explanation of this symbolic action is going to be an interpretation of what the sword is all about. It's about the invasion of Nebuchadnezzar. It's about his way making south. But there's a military decision that Nebuchadnezzar has to make. And this symbolic action is all about this great decision as to which way, which country Nebuchadnezzar is to attack first, Ammon or Judah. And so as to this symbolic action in verse 19, mortal, mark out two roads for the sword of the king of Babylon. There we are, interpretation for the first time in historical terms. For the sword of the king of Babylon to come, both of them shall issue from the same land. And so there is this one road, what we call the Fertile Crescent, coming up from Mesopotamia and going across to Assyria. And then there's a parting of the ways. You can go different ways. And Nebuchadnezzar seems to be at this point in the mind of God at Damascus. And he seems to have made his military headquarters at Damascus, but he's going to send his troops to the various countries that are going to be attacked down in the south, countries that have rebelled against his imperial authority. But there's a choice. And from Damascus, he can go straight down. And if he goes straight down, he's going to go through the Transjordan, and he's going to end up at Ammon. That's the first choice. And he can focus his attack on the capital of Ammon, Rabbah. So that's one choice. But alternatively, he could go down the coast road. From Damascus, he could go over to the coast, and he could go down, follow the coastline by the sea road, and then he could turn left off into Judah as he got near the bottom of that coast road. And so that's the choice. Which is he going to do? And Nebuchadnezzar has no idea, no idea. And evidently his military officers don't know which, and perhaps they think, well, does it matter, you know? But Nebuchadnezzar wants to do the right thing. And what do you do if you're a foreign king? You consult the gods, and you look for omens. This is what you have to do. And so you have some diviners among the military staff who will carry out this omen seeking and to be able to interpret properly. And so there it is. There it is. There's the choice. But going back to the symbolic vision, we've got this journey across the Fertile Crescent and down to Damascus, and then a fork in the road comes. And which way is he to go? Make a signpost. Make it for a fork in the road leading to a city. Verse 20, mark out the road for the sword to come to Rabbah of the Ammonites, or to Judah and to Jerusalem the fortified. For the king of Babylon stands at the parting of the way, at the fork in the two roads. To use divination, there we are. And so there were various ways of getting at a prediction of which was the right thing to do. There were these pagan ways to shake the arrows from the quiver and see how they fell out, what direction they fell out. And that could give you a good clue. Or you could consult the teraphim. There were these images which had a way of telling the truth. Or you could take an animal and cut it up and look at the liver. Very fruitful way of finding out what you should do if you inspect the liver. And there was a whole science of omens as to how you interpreted the liver when it was cut out of an animal. And then you could take lots. You could take lots and have two lots, two stones, one for Jerusalem and one for Ammon, and shake them up and see which one came out. Well, when he did all that, it turned out very definitely to be Jerusalem. That was the answer from the gods. So that was the way he was going to go. And there's this very interesting pagan way of determining how a military campaign should be carried out. And the Judean heroes, Judean prisoners of war, they wouldn't like this way of speaking. This is odd. You know, what's he going? We don't believe in this stuff. You know, what's he going into all this for? But verse 22, into his right hand comes the lot for Jerusalem. And so that's the answer. And so he realizes that in his future, in the military future of his army, there's going to be a siege for Jerusalem. To set battering rams, to call out for slaughter, raising the battle cry, set battering rams against the gates, to cast up rams and to build siege towers. Jerusalem had been called the fortified city. It had these wonderful walls, splendid strong walls, and so the only way to get in would be by a siege, and eventually to break down with various way with these ramps and these siege towers and so on. Now, verse 23, the text comes to terms with the pagan nature of what's being taught. All this omen seeking, you know, the prisoners of war would turn up their noses at mention of that and say, aha, there was something going on. To them, it will seem like a false divination. God is speaking to Ezekiel about the prisoners of war who are going to be listening to this. And he says, they won't like this talk. And then, no, we don't like this way of thinking. They have sworn solemn oaths, but he brings their guilt to remembrance, bringing about their capture. And what's really is being said here is that God is supreme over this, and God is working through these omens, and from God ultimately comes this order. Nebuchadnezzar is really the agent of this coming siege of Jerusalem, and it will be because Jerusalem deserves it. So that's where we are. And so Jerusalem is going to be his first target. Nebuchadnezzar's mind is made up, and there's that terrible truth revealed in advance through Ezekiel. And he's got to send his soldiers down that southwestern road that will take them to Jerusalem. And there's going to be a siege warfare. Right. But then moving on, in 25 to 27, there's a focusing upon Zedekiah, the king, the head of the government of Judah in Jerusalem. King Zedekiah is singled out, and he was the one who would be, in fact, Judah's last king. And the message comes to the prisoners of war that he's going to lose his throne. And it means the end of his reign. And even now, through Ezekiel, far away in Babylon, God's orders ring out to strip Zedekiah of his royal power as part of the overthrow of the social order in Judah. As for you, vile, wicked prince of Israel, you whose day is come, the time of final punishment. Remember how, was it President Truman used to say, the buck stops here. I've got to bear ultimate responsibility for government decisions and the way that the land is governed. And so the buck stopped at Zedekiah. So remove the turban, take off the crown. Things shall not remain as they are. There's going to be a ruin, absolute ruin. And then the fourth and last sword message occurs in verses 28 to 32. And it draws actually on the language of the earlier message. It's a summary. It has the form of a summary to a large extent. And so it presents a climax to the earlier message. And it goes back to talking about the sword. And it says that eventually Ammon, too, will be attacked. That after Jerusalem, there will be a going to Rabbah concerning the Ammonites. And so this sword, you get the language again, drawn for slaughter, polished to consume, to flash like lightning. And then those whose day has come, the time of final punishment. We've just read that about Zedekiah in chapter 25. And so former language is being picked up here. But then there's a surprising development, because the sword is given a new order. Return it to its sheath. Your work is done. Your work is done. Return it to its sheath in the place where you were created, in the land of your origin. Go back home, sword. Go back home, Babylonians, to the place you came from. I will judge you, sword equals Babylon. I will judge you. I will pour out my indignation upon you With the fire of my wrath I will blow upon you. I will deliver you into brutish hands, those skillful to destroy. You shall be fuel for the fire. Oh my, it picks up that initial message for the whole section about the fire. You shall be fuel for the fire. Your blood shall enter the earth. You shall be remembered no more, for I, the Lord, have spoken. This is the only place in the book of Ezekiel where we have the final fate of the Babylonians. All the rest is focused on Judah suffering, and then Judah going back to its land, but nothing is said elsewhere. In Jeremiah it is. Book of Jeremiah makes much of the final fate of Babylon. And in fact, this is something of a theme in the classical prophets. And it goes back to Isaiah. And there's a very impressive passage which sets out a double program for Israel's enemies. And you get in Isaiah chapter 10, and it's in verses 5 through 15. And it's in two parts. First of all, it's speaking back in Assyria's time. First of all, it says, Assyria, the rod of my anger. God is going to use Assyria against his own people. Against a godless nation I send him. Against the people of my wrath I command him. And this, in the context, is none other than Judah. To take spoil and seize plunder, to tread them down like mire in the streets. But this is not what he intends. Assyria goes beyond the divine mandate and takes part in destruction, absolute destruction of people and places. And he boasts of what he can do because his gods are behind him, and says Assyria. And so there's that arrogance there of Assyria. But then there's a switch, and it comes in verse 12 of Isaiah 10. When the Lord has finished all his work on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, he will punish the arrogant boasting of the king of Assyria and his haughty pride. Shall the axe vault itself against the one who wields it? The Assyrian is my agent, and so he's not to go beyond my will. And so there's this double program in God's purposes. First there is enemy, foreign enemy that is to attack Judah, but then God turns his attention to that enemy, and the enemy gets punished in turn. And this ultimately, of course, is a matter of hope for Judah. And so this is where we are. This is a sort of rerun of Isaiah 10, chapter verses 5 through 15, but now it's Nebuchadnezzar, and now it's Babylon, the successor of Assyria, which is caught up in this double program. But there's just a brief mention, and it's put in mysterious terms. You don't actually say Babylon. You don't actually say Nebuchadnezzar, and you go back to this vague talk of the sword. There might be spies. There might be spies ready to report what was being said, and so one must be careful. So use this code word again, the sword, but making plain to those who've got ears to hear that eventually that great imperial power of Babylon will fall. And so there's a hint of hope there in speaking of the eventual downfall of Judah's enemy. And so there we are. There are these sword passages in this chapter. We move on to chapter 22. And as I said at the beginning, we get behind the punishment of chapter 21 to the reasons for it. After the punishment, you get accusations, which is not a normal order in an oracle of judgment, but this is the order which is very visibly, vividly presented here in moving from 21 to 22. So it probes into why does this have to happen? Why does this punishment have to happen? And the focus is still on Jerusalem, as it had been in the earlier chapter. And there are three messages. After the initial introductory formula, the word of the Lord came to me, you have 2 through 16, and then 18 through 22, and 24 through 31. This formula of prophetic authority is the preface in each case. The word of the Lord came to me. And we have a key word in the first message. It's the word blood. The word blood runs through it. And it warrants the initial description of Jerusalem in verse 2 as the bloody city. It might be better to adopt the rendering of the NIV, the city of bloodshed, which brings out a bit more vividly what it means, the city of bloodshed. And this message is going to be picking up this word blood all the way through. It's going to sidestep to a variety of sins that have been committed in Jerusalem, but it keeps coming back to this bloodshed and the wrongful taking of human life. And then another factor that's brought to the fore is the neglect of the traditional obligation not to worship idols. And this is set out at the beginning. Verse 3, thus says the Lord God, a city shedding blood within itself, its time is come, making its idols, defiling itself. And so two items are put there. And these two features, holding human life cheap and engaging in image-related worship, have set God's clock ticking towards a time of reckoning. And so the time has come. Verse 3, verse 4, you brought your day near. The appointed time of your years is come. And so eventually there must be punishment for these accusations that are going to be set out, which are summarized at this early point. There's going to be a time of reckoning, and God's going to intervene in a terrible reprisal. In fact, it says in verse 4, therefore I have made you a disgrace, talking to Jerusalem rhetorically, I have made you a disgrace before the nations and a mockery to all the countries, looking back at 597. But the implication is that we're moving towards 587, which will be much worse. Verses 6 through 12 is a roll call of wrongdoing. The royal house over the generations have set a bad example to the citizens of Jerusalem. The princes of Israel, everyone according to his power, have been bent on shedding blood, and that practice has been picked up by the citizens. And the government has misused its political power. And commoners, too, have rushed to show their lack of respect for fellow citizens. And father and mother are treated with contempt. The alien resided within you suffers extortion. The orphan and widow are wronged in you. And in various ways, there's this wrongdoing. In you are those who slander to shed blood, and so on. And a whole variety of ways. And we get a roll call that very close to the priestly list that we've had in chapter 18 earlier on. And then too, there was engaging in those pagan feasts, eating upon the mountains and at these high places that had been singled out in an earlier chapter. There was also a lack of respect for God by breaking his Sabbaths. There's a mention of the profaning my Sabbaths. There were two types of Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath and the Sabbath in terms of years, every 7 years. But there'd be no respect for either requirement set out in the Torah. And then in verse 13, God's response to all these interpersonal offenses by saying he's clapping his hands. And here now it is a gesture of protest in the context. And there's a looking ahead to the breakup of the community in 587, a general deportation that Jerusalem citizens were going to suffer after the deporting of the elite in 597. Drastic as it was, and though it would mean the loss of reputation, it would harm the reputation of Israel's God among other nations, it was the only way to deal with the situation. Verse 16 says, I shall be profaned through you in the sight of the nations. I'm going to lose my good name, and my holy name, my powerful name by doing so. They'll say, oh, how weak Yahweh was that he couldn't protect his people from the Babylonian gods. But nevertheless, this is the only way to go, the only way forward. To profane means to treat as common rather than holy, and so to despise. And then 18 to 22 are dominated by a metaphor drawn from the work of the silversmith. And Ezekiel has, in fact, borrowed it from an earlier prophet, from the book of Isaiah and chapter 1, where speaking about Jerusalem, it says, your silver has become dross. Your silver has become dross. Now, Ezekiel was a master of metaphor and a master at developing metaphors and extending them. And so he takes up this reference to trying to get silver and the work of the silversmith. And he's speaking about the raw material of the silversmith, which was actually lead ore, a mixture of lead and other metals, including silver. And the eventual aim was to get to the silver. But in the coming day, what we know as 587, the lead ore of Judah, which is what it had degenerated to, was going to be put into the smelting furnace. And Jerusalem would be the smelting furnace. And smelting is here the fire of judgment that Jerusalem was going to endure. And metaphorically, it's describing as subjecting the lead ore to enough heat to melt the silver, to melt that ore and leave behind, to get the silver and leave behind the dross of other metallic elements. But here the emphasis is on the smelting process, and there's no thought of that extra step of actually getting to the silver, and it's the fire of the smelting furnace that comes to the fore here as an end in itself. And then in 24 to 31, we have the third message, which starts by addressing Jerusalem and then describing the failings of the various leadership groupings in Jerusalem. They'd all failed in carrying out their proper duties. And the last verse indicates that this particular message is looking back at 587. Verse 31, therefore I have poured out my indignation upon them. I have consumed them. I have consumed them. With the fire of my wrath, I have returned their conduct upon their heads. And so this was after the event, this was a recapitulation of why it happened. And its certainty for the future in the other messages is secured by saying it did happen, and now we can look on it as a thing of the past. Chapter 23 is a history lesson. And it's used to tell the message of Judah's sinfulness. And so Judah's liability for coming punishment in 587. And it uses wrong sexuality as a metaphor throughout here. And it employs language that the first hearers, those 597 exiles, they would have regarded as unnecessarily coarse and vulgar. We're back in the situation of chapter 16. Ezekiel's doing it again, using these nasty words, these unpleasant words, and oh my, these shocking words. And of course, the intention is to shock the prisoners of war into accepting what they do not want to hear. And so it has to be exaggerated. It's a way of shouting at a group that wanted to turn a deaf ear and trying to make them listen. I'll shock you into listening. So there. And so in both respects, chapter 23 is very much like chapter 16, when Jerusalem was portrayed as God's unfaithful wife. But in 16, that unfaithfulness was mainly religious. It was set out mainly religious in chapter 16, with a glance at a political side of their unfaithfulness. But the presentation in chapter 23 is the other way round, and it stresses the political unfaithfulness in making alliances and treaties with other nations, and then the religious unfaithfulness comes in as a side issue. And so there's that contrast there. In some of the prophetic books, political entanglements with other nations is regarded as a sort of alternative faith. Back in Isaiah's time, when Hezekiah tried to make an alliance with Egypt to get the Assyrians off their back, we find the prophet Isaiah speaking in this way in chapter 30, in verses 2 and 3. It speaks of, without asking for my counsel, envoys have been sent to make an alliance, to take refuge in the protection of Pharaoh, to seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. And that, those phrases, to take refuge and seek shelter, is part of the vocabulary of faith in the Old Testament. But now this is an alternative faith. Therefore the protection of Pharaoh shall become your shame, and the shelter in the shadow of Egypt your humiliation. And chapter 31 in verse 1, alas for those who go down to Egypt for help, who rely on horses, who trust in chariots and in horsemen, but do not look to the Holy One of Israel or consult the Lord. And so this old theme among the classical prophets, it's being taken up here. And Hosea did it too, for the northern kingdom. Hosea chapter 8 and verse 9. They've gone up to Assyria. Ephraim has bargained for lovers. But here in Hosea, you get this sexual imagery. It's not only wrong and unfaithful, but there's this sort of lovers. The Assyrians are the new lovers of the northern kingdom, for the northern kingdom, instead of Yahweh himself. And so there's a mixture of what Isaiah had to say, a tirade against alliances as being unfaithful, and then what Assyria had to say, that there's a sort of sexual metaphor you can use about this unfaithfulness, seeking new lovers. But here, then, in chapter 23, history was repeating itself, and Judah had got entangled in these various alliances in order to get the best possible deal that it could. And especially under Zedekiah, there'd been an appeal to Egypt before the siege and then during the siege. And the Egyptians had come, the Egyptian army had come. The Babylonian army, we're told in a verse in Jeremiah, had broken off the siege and moved to the southwest to deal with the Egyptians, and deal with them they did. And the Egyptians were forced back. The Babylonians came back and resumed their siege of Jerusalem. So that didn't work in point of fact. This unfaithfulness against God, from Ezekiel's point of view, didn't work. And chapter 23 is a literary unit. It's split up into three smaller groups, 2 to 27, 28 to 35, 36 to 49. There's this review of ancient history here, a whole history of this political unfaithfulness down the ages. Any powerful nation, the people of God, took the opportunity to make alliances with them, to make their lot better. And we need to remember that initially, at an earlier stage for centuries, there had been two kingdoms, the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. And this is picked up here. And interestingly enough, these are portrayed as God's two wives. God has got two wives, which is very striking. But we find it in another prophet too, in Jeremiah 6 through 13. The Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom are God's two wives. And here they are now. And they've got names, Ohalah and Oholibah. And Ohalah means her tent. And Oholibah means my tent is in her. And nobody's quite sure as to what the tent refers to. But in the context of marriage, it probably means the marriage tent in which the marriage was consummated. And even today, you may know, a Jewish couple is married under a canopy, which is a sort of a relic of the marriage tent. And so there are these two wives, and they became mine, and they bore sons and daughters. And then you get an identification. Ohalah is Samaria, and Oholibah is Jerusalem. Well, actually, this interpretation is taken from the end of the chapter where this is so. But earlier on, it seems that the nations are in view. The Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. And this is speaking nationally rather than in terms of capitals. But there's this playing the whore when she's mine. And first it was the Northern Kingdom involved with the Assyrians. And then we've got these awful talk of these sexual affairs how Israel fell for these Assyrians, and how handsome they were in their military uniforms, and so on. And it's all very, very shocking. And then we come in verse 11 to Oholibah, Judah in the south, and then the same things happens with the Assyrians, and then with the Chaldeans or Babylonians, and there are these love affairs being carried on. So this is the way that it's talking, a shocking way to represent the political unfaithfulness of not only the Northern Kingdom, which the Judeans would readily agree with perhaps, but even the Southern Kingdom. And so Judah was just as bad in point of fact. So 5 to 10 is a summary of the history of the Northern Kingdom under Assyrian domination in the 8th century BC. And as we saw, Hosea saw what was going on, and he called the Assyrians the lovers of the Northern Kingdom. And so this is being picked up here. And then in 11 to 21, Ezekiel turns to the subsequent history of Judah, politically involved first with Assyria and then with Babylon, and now flirting with Egypt. And so it's come into contemporary times now, under Zedekiah, and this reenacting of ancient history, this big no-no of what was unfaithfulness against God in a political way. And so verses 11 to 21 against Judah, it's really an accusation. And so it's not surprising that in verse 22, we have that word therefore, which is a bridging word very often between accusation and punishment. Therefore, I will arouse against you your lovers. They're going to turn against you, and that they're going to be your destruction, those you've made alliances with. All right. And God was going to use the Babylonians eventually as agents of his own punishment. There's a little clause in verse 24. I will commit the judgment to them. I will commit the judgment to them. And they shall judge you according to their ordinances, which may very well be more cruel than any ordinances you have been used to. And then 28 to 35, lastly, serves to reflect on this coming experiences. And if you glance through, in the middle, you've got a poem, a little poem, in 32 to 34. But on either side, you've got prose. So you have a prose passage, 28 to 31, then this poem in 32 through 34, and then finally a little bit of prose in verse 35. And so that's the sort of literary structure there with the difference between prose and poetry. But when you come to the poetry, you bring in a new metaphor. We find a new metaphor. And this is the cup of judgment. The cup of judgment. And 32, you shall drink your sister's cup. Just as the northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians, so you finally are going to fall to the Babylonians, your former lovers that you were glad to make a treaty with. You shall drink your sister's cup. You shall be scorned and derided. It's deep and wide, and it holds so much. You shall be filled with drunkenness and sorrow. A cup of horror and desolation is the cup of your sister Samaria. And at this point, the sisters described as Samaria, and that which was the capital of the northern kingdom, and that was what was put back at the end of verse 4. And so there's this intoxicating cup, this very strong liquor. And Judah's going to be knocked out by it and destroyed by it, and that's the very fateful new metaphor. The prophets use it a fair number of times, and then of course it gets carried over. We may remember into the New Testament that cup of judgment. Jesus said, "Can you drink the cup that I am going to drink," referring back to this very metaphor. And then the last message in verses 36 to 49 returns to the to two sisters, and there's renewed accusation in 36 to 45 now for religious unfaithfulness to God, especially child sacrifice in 36 and 39. And then for political unfaithfulness in 42 to 44. And then a prediction of punishment comes lastly in 46 to 49. And this would mean the death. The sisters were going to be put to death with their families, and the destruction of their homes. And this was the only way that God's people could come to appreciate the reality and nature of their God. Notice the very last clause in verse 49. And you shall know that I am the Lord. There was no easier way of God teaching the lesson of what it meant, what it should mean to be a faithful follower of Yahweh. Next time, we should be looking at chapter 24.
This is Dr. Leslie Allen in his teaching on the book of Ezekiel. This is session number 11, God's Sword Against Sinful Jerusalem and Judah. Ezekiel chapter 20, verses 45 through chapter 23, verse 49.